Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Every culture has its history and its myths. The United States is no different. The history is fairly identifiable, as are the myths, sometimes. For example, we know the story of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree is apocryphal. But other myths become history. Think of how the story of Christopher Columbus was taught for generations. Still, other myths are still being taught as history. And that's the case for our neighbor to the south, Texas, and one of the most cherished symbols of their history, the Alamo. My guest today and his two co-authors have taken direct aim at the legend and tell the true story of the battle, as well as the battles over this symbol that are still being fought to this day. Chris Tomlinson is a columnist for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express-Mail. Prior to that, he was a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press. He and his co-authors Brian Burrow and Jason Stanford tell the real reason 150-plus men fought Santa Anna's Mexican Army in the late winter of 1836 and died at the Alamo. And it wasn't independence foremost in mind, and it wasn't fighting oppression, although probably in their minds it was, because the real reason was many of the leaders were slave traders and slave owners, and Mexico wanted to abolish slavery in Texas. Tomlinson's book is titled Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. It's published by Penguin, and he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Chris Tomlinson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
As I was reading Forget the Alamo, my mind would drift every once in a while to your state's anti-littering campaign motto, which is Don't Mess with Texas. You know, that's an interesting motto because there's an implicit threat there. And I kept thinking, here's three writers really messing with Texas. Why did you and your co-authors decide to tackle the story surrounding the Battle of the Alamo?
Well, you know, there's so many lies littering the Alamo, we had to go pick them up, just like the littering campaign said we should. It's time. It's time that we get to be honest about the origin myth of Texas. And, you know, we like to say that our book is a historiography. It's as much a history of the history as it is delving into the facts of what happened at the Alamo. And for too long, we have relied on myths and stories that have very little to do with the truth and a lot about keeping a certain segment of the population in power.
Thanks to Hollywood, we have, even people that only have a marginal interest in Texas, have an ingrained memory and history about the Alamo and the Texas Revolution. And like most Hollywood histories, there's just maybe a nub of truth there. So let's get to the main misconception I think all of us have, that the Battle of the Alamo and the battle for Texas independence was not about escaping despotic rule from Mexico. It was about the same thing that was being engaged across the American South, slavery. Tell us about that.
So the reason why Anglos came to Texas was because the cotton plantations and cotton farms in Alabama and Mississippi were being farmed out. You know, they just weren't producing as well. And Texas had, in the Houston area, this perfect land for growing cotton. And that was what the Americans were after. It wasn't to, you know, become subsistence farmers. They were going to bring their slaves and grow cotton. In 1821, though, the Mexicans threw off the yoke of Spanish colonial rule. They became this egalitarian, multi-ethnic society that was opposed to slavery. And the only way they were able to balance this out for a decade was through federalism, that the Mexican states can write their own rules. And the white Texans pretty much got everything they wanted. Less than a year before the Battle of the Alamo, the whites defeated Santa Anna. They welcomed him into their community as being a great Mexican leader. The only problem was Santa Anna wanted to end slavery, and that was really the underlying cause of the revolt, and therefore the Battle of the Alamo had a lot more to do with slavery than liberty.
Well, in fact, most of the people we recognize as heroes from the Alamo, Jim Bowie, William Travis, many of them were, in fact, slave traders.
Well, they were men of the South. They were white men of the South who were interested in making money. And the best way was through trading slaves. Jim Bowie would buy smuggled slaves from pirates in Galveston and smuggle them into Louisiana. William Travis was a probate attorney in Alabama and would cheat his dead clients out of their slaves so that he could resell them and make more money. Travis had a slave with him at the Alamo. So this was a fundamental part of who these people were.
There's a great line in the book, a great paragraph, where you look at the accommodations the Mexican government had made. It was like basically Santa Anna had given the Texas province just about everything that they wanted, except he was wanting to put a sunset on slavery. And, you know, they rose up and they were fighting, you know, they weren't paying taxes. give us a sense of what the accommodations the Mexican government made.
You know, the Texians, that's the name for white Texans at the time, they didn't want to pay duties on imported goods or on the exports of cotton. The previous Mexican government had tried to use soldiers to enforce duties and tariffs. The whites had killed Mexican soldiers for trying to enforce Mexican law in Mexico. There was no restriction on their land ownership. They were allowed to hold their slaves when slavery was banned in every other part of Mexico. The only condition, as you point out, was that the Mexican government wanted that to end. They wanted an end date for when slavery would no longer be allowed. And Santa Anna was a ruthless general. He massacred civilians. He did lots of horrible things, but he was also a very clever, successful Mexican politician. And he knew that slavery was the line. That was the one thing he could not tolerate, and it was the one thing Americans needed to protect their wealth.
Of course, one of the other stories of the Alamo is that this was the Texians, if you will, the white Texans that rose up. But in fact, it was a variety of folks. The Tejanos were also involved. And after the battle, after independence, that part of the history was whitewashed.
Oh, completely. You know, it was the Tejanos who first made the call to arms when Santa Anna became a dictator, when he suspended the Constitution. The Tejanos had been living on the frontier for a long time. They were used to having their autonomy. And they, along with many other Mexican states, recognized that Santa Anna's suspension of the Constitution was bad news. So the Tejanos were actually the ones who were fighting for Mexican democracy. They were fighting for Mexican federalism, and they wanted the white Texians to join them. It was during the siege of the Alamo that the white Texians said, no, we're not fighting for Mexico. We're going to fight for independence. And that's when things began to turn. That's when the Texians began to push out the Tejano leaders and the Mexican-American leaders who were involved in fighting Santa Anna. And then, of course, when they had victory, there was a campaign of ethnic cleansing where Anglos basically made sure that no Tejano would ever hold any strategic land, that they weren't allowed to participate in the government, and they established the most militant slave nation in the history of the world.
In fact, one of the defenders of the Alamo that was sent out as a messenger a few days before it fell, Juan Seguin, considered one of the heroes of the Alamo, is forced into exile. He has to go to Mexico.
Yes, and he's not getting any help from his friends. Sam Houston decorated Juan Seguin for his valor at the Battle of San Jacinto. Juan had taught Stephen F. Austin Spanish, and Stephen F. Austin had taught Juan English. Juan was the commander of the Texas Army in San Antonio until these, you know, white racists who were participating in the government came in and started making these baseless accusations against Juan. They tried to hunt him down to kill him, and that's when he fled to Mexico and was thrown in prison.
It's interesting. We refer to the Alamo's history. You really refer to it as myths. So what are some of the other myths that are most enduring about that time in particular? I think one is that the idea that this was some sort of doomed effort, that all the men died in the battle. And, you know, there's always been debates over whether David Crockett died in the battle or whether he died afterwards. In fact, I think a lot of historians believe that he did try to surrender and, of course, was executed after the battle. But what are some of the myths surrounding the battle that we should know that's important to the story today?
Well, you know, for 100 years, Texas historians ignored Mexican reports about what happened at the Alamo and just rejected them wholesale. So among the things we know, there was no line in the sand. That was invented by an amateur historian 38 years after the battle, and there's no basis for that, in fact. We know that Travis offered to surrender the night before Santa Anna attacked. He was trying to negotiate a surrender, and Santa Anna would have none of it. When the fighting began, within the first 15 minutes, at least half or a third to half of the people inside fled the Alamo and were chased down by Mexican cavalry in the fields around it. They did not fight to the death. And finally, we know from the Mexican reports that David Crockett did surrender, that he did try to pass himself off as a naturalist who just kind of accidentally got caught up in the battle. And then Santa Anna ordered him executed anyway. And once you know these things, then suddenly the dam begins to break and you have to start considering all the other things you think you know.
And what are some of the other things you think you know about this Texas revolt?
Well, that somehow it wasn't about slavery, that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a Mexican invasion. It was an American invasion. You know, it was thousands of Anglos who crossed into Mexico illegally and then squatted on land that was the property of the Mexican government. Santa Anna did not have to invade. He was coming to enforce Mexican law on people who had pledged their allegiance to Mexico. These were not Americans, technically. These were people who had promised to respect Mexican laws and become members of the Catholic Church. If you just reframe this a little tiny bit, it becomes a colonial attack, not a fight for liberty.
Now, one of the other stories is United States' hand in this revolution or revolt. Certainly at the Battle of San Jacinto, you raise evidence that, in fact, there were military men from the United States among the Texians that attacked at San Jacinto, which, in fact, resulted in Santa Anna's capture, the destruction of his army, and eventually independence.
This is some of the most fascinating new research. And I want to just say that we stand on the shoulders of amazing modern-day historians who are digging into this stuff. You know, there was an article in the Southwestern Quarterly where they documented how very systematically an entire company of U.S. troops in Louisiana deserted and suddenly show up on the muster rolls of Sam Houston's army at the Battle of San Jacinto. We know that the cannons that were so critical to the victory were donated by business people in Cincinnati and then manned by U.S. artillerymen and used to great effectiveness to defeat Santa Anna's army. And then, of course, these people then show up back on the muster rolls of the U.S. Army a few months later, and they weren't court-martialed. We dig into the politics. There is no doubt that there were American politicians were behind this. It was American money that financed the Texan Revolution, and that this was part of an American plan to eventually take over Texas, something that Washington had wanted for at least 20 years.
My guest today is Chris Tomlinson, a columnist for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, and one of three co-authors of Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. It's published by Penguin, which talks about the Battle of the Alamo and all the battles since. I should mention what we've talked about so far is only probably about the first two-fifths of the book. The rest of the book is about the battles about the Alamo well after 1836. And this is really some interesting stories, too. After the Texas Revolt, you know, the Alamo lay abandoned for years. It sort of became a tourist attraction of sorts in the late 1800s, but even 50 years after independence of Texas, it was still largely abandoned. When did the Alamo become important again, and why?
Well, it really owes a debt to Adina Dozabala, the granddaughter of the first vice president of Texas, and at the time, Texas's wealthiest woman, Clara Driscoll. They were both obsessed with Texas history. They both wanted to preserve Texas history and were shocked at the state of the Alamo and how poorly it was maintained. And at the time, you know, women were not allowed to vote. They weren't allowed to hold political office. And yet they formed these heritage societies, like the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, where they were able to assert tremendous political influence. So if you were a woman with ambition, you joined one of these heritage societies and got involved in preservation and school curricula, and it was how you had a role in shaping the world. And so really, you know, the Alamo became what it was under 100 years of being supervised by the Daughters of the Republic of Texas.
And when did it become sort of required reading to read the story of the Alamo? Was that like late 1800s, early 1900s?
Right. I mean, the formal study of history, the first historians began working in Texas only after the first university was established in 1886, the first public university. And even then, though, the Texas legislature was very strict about this is what you're going to teach and this is the story you're going to tell. And that's what starts showing up in the school books, and that's what starts showing up in the state curriculum. And to this day, Texas teachers are required by law to say that the defenders of the Alamo were heroes.
Interesting. Is there a change against that? Is there sort of backlash against that? I mean, there's been all sorts of revisionist thinking and all sorts of history, but you say really the story of Texas independence has been somewhat immune to that. Why is that, in your view?
You know, we talked to some historians and who explained that in the middle of the 20th century, if you were a Texas historian, you were basically dooming yourself to teaching high school history. It was very declassé. It was not, you know, if you were a serious historian, you worked on American history or bigger topics. And so really the field was ceded to amateur historians, and that's who repeated the old myths over and over again. It wasn't until the 1960s that you begin to see Chicano historians stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, I've been hearing these stories about what really happened at the Alamo since I was a little kid. It's been passed down through my family. We have a different story to tell. And that started a whole new wave of research in the 70s, 80s. And then by the 90s, you've got people who are very serious going through the documents and explaining, hey, wait a minute. You know, everything you think you know about the Alamo is untrue.
What's also interesting is how Hollywood glommed onto the story of the Battle of the Alamo. I think I read there's no less than like 8 or 9 movies over the course of, you know, motion picture history, going back to D.W. Griffith in 1915, all the way to the most recent Alamo film in 2004. Why has this been such a powerful image for Hollywood?
You know, I think it's a short story, right? It only lasts 13 days. it's easy to process. For most of the filmmaking, it was always slightly racist. It was a way of showing these proud, stalwart, stoic white men standing up to masses of dark-skinned, mustachioed villains. I mean, that's certainly the way D.W. Griffith portrayed it in Martyrs of the Alamo. It was all about Mexican officers raping white women. And then you get to Walt Disney, where it becomes a stand-in for the Cold War. You know, the Mexicans are the communists, and the heroes of the Alamo are the ones standing up to oppression. And that's the same story that John Wayne told in his film, which has almost nothing to do with the truth, except for the names of the people involved. You know, and this is typical of many of our stories that we tell ourselves. And different generations frame the story in different ways to suit their purposes and suit their needs of their era. And I think we're entering an era today where Texans are, 41% of Texans are Anglo. Soon Hispanics will be the majority in Texas. And we need to tell a rounder, more multi-ethnic, more nuanced story about the Alamo's 300-year history, not just 13 days in 1836.
Yeah, I find it interesting that, you know, the Alamo, the John Wayne film, shows up in the height of the Cold War, 1960. And, of course, after 9/11, 3 years later, comes the most recent story of the Alamo, 2004. It's almost like it's a stand-in for these times of national strife.
It is. It is. It's a symbol of American resilience. It's a symbol of American courage. You know, I was a war correspondent for 16 years. I went to spent 2 years in Iraq. I spent time in Afghanistan, and wherever there's an American soldier, a forward operating base, someone has scrawled the words "The Alamo" across the sandbags, because it's the idea of standing up for what you believe in. That's what it's become a metaphor for. And I kept asking these soldiers in Iraq, you know, you ought to stop doing that because, you know, they lost at the Alamo, right? a lot of them didn't even know that, you know, they just knew what the symbol was. It's become shorthand for courage, and that's not quite right. We have to be a little more honest about it.
My guest today is Chris Tomlinson, a columnist for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News. He is one of three co-authors, along with Brian Burrow and Jason Stanford, of Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. It's published by Penguin. Really interesting history that tells a very different story of the Texas Revolution than you've ever read before, at least if you haven't read scholarly histories. This is a very popular history, and it talks about the sort of the current battles that are still happening over the Alamo, and one is going on in Texas right now, and it's about a $450 million plan to renovate the Alamo Plaza, and it involves, of all people, musician Phil Collins, who apparently is an Alamo collector. He's collected lots of artifacts and wants to give it to the state of Texas, and this is an ongoing debate as well.
Yeah, Phil grew up with the Walt Disney TV show. When he was a little kid, he drew the Alamo on his garden wall at his house in London. And when he made a lot of money with Genesis and as a solo singer, he started buying up every Alamo artifact he could find. You know, Texas needed a good reason to build a museum, and they convinced Collins to hand over the collection in return for building a brand new $300 million museum on Alamo Plaza. The only problem is that experts tell us many of the items that Phil claims to be authentic probably are not, including a Bowie knife that supposedly belonged to Jim Bowie, but that authentication is based on a psychic. we have a shot pouch that supposedly belonged to Davy Crockett, but it was bought from a shady guy who was later killed in a drug cartel assassination. We're saying that, you know, maybe before we spend $300 million of taxpayer money to build a museum, perhaps we should make sure those objects really are what Phil Collins says they are.
And, of course, the whole battle over the site today continues. Apparently, there is a Woolworths that was a site of a sit-in counter. You know, people want to tear that down, and other people want to preserve it. It was at one point an ancient Indian burial ground. There's all sorts of people fighting over this little piece of space, even today.
Well, you know, we joke that that San Antonio, Alamo Plaza, is basically the Jerusalem of Texas, right? Everyone can lay claim to it. You know, it was a Spanish mission, that 300-year-old Spanish mission. So you have the story of the Spanish missionaries. There are still roughly 1,500 Native Americans buried under the street in front of the Alamo. And these are the Tapalam tribe members who converted to Christianity and were honored by, you know, and their honor to honor them, the Spanish missionaries buried them inside the Alamo compound. as you said, there's the Woolworth building right across the street where African Americans protested for desegregation and won an important victory. And then, of course, you know, there's the Mexican Americans who, for whom Alamo Plaza has been the center of the city. It's where you gather. It's where you hold fiesta. It's where you hold block parties. So everyone's got a claim on it. And what we're saying is, you know, those who think the only thing that counts are 13 days in 1836 need to open their minds and see that the Alamo is so much more and, frankly, so much more interesting.
Of course, one of the things you write in the book that you hope will happen will spur conversations that have been going on throughout the South and many places in the country about, you know, that has gone about Confederate monuments, statues, and names. Well, you have tons of names in Texas that are related to Texas independence, you know, Travis High School, you know, towns named after Crockett, Bowie, Austin, you know, that's some really major landmarks and geographic places that are named for these people that were, again, touting slavery and fought to preserve slavery, much like in the Civil War.
You know, I think that's what's finally dawning on Texas is that, you know, the Texas Revolt was kind of a precursor to the Civil War, that the Alamo is a proto-Confederate monument of sorts if the only thing we honor it for is those 13 days in 1836. We need to have some difficult conversations, and I'm not saying that the city of Austin needs to rename itself, but we need a fuller explanation about why we honor these people and what they represent to us.
Hmm. What's the reaction to this book in Texas? Is this being welcomed, or are you worried about having them leave the state? Or because I know there are a lot of people that really take this Alamo thing very seriously today.
Well, you know, we are getting a lot of blowback. My social media accounts are kind of blowing up right now. And, you know, you can't, you know, in many ways we're heretics to those people. But I'm very heartened by the fact that so many young people who want to know the truth, and certainly the Hispanic plurality in Texas, they're very supportive because, you know what, they're tired of Anglos walking up and punching them in the arm and saying, remember the Alamo. They're ready for a truer story to be told.
Chris Tomlinson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Chris Tomlinson is a columnist for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News. He and his co-authors Brian Burrow and Jason Stanford are the co-authors of Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.